This is a reading of A Theory of Knowledge, Implicit in Goethe's World Conception by Rudolf Steiner. It is number 2 in the bibliographic survey. It was published in 1886. Steiner was then 25. And an attempt at the German title is Grundlinien einer Erkenntnistheorie der Goethischen Weltanschauung. And I'm going to start right at the beginning and not read the prefaces. I'll put them at the end if I read them at all. A. Preliminary questions. Number 1. The point of departure. When we trace any one of the intellectual currents of the present time back to its source, we invariably arrive at one of the great spirits of our classical age. Goethe or Schiller, Herder or Lessing gave an impulse, and from this impulse has issued this or that intellectual movement, which continues even today. Our whole German culture is based so squarely upon the great writers of that epoch that many who consider themselves entirely original achieve nothing more than the expression of what was long ago intimated by Goethe or Schiller. We have entered into such a living union with the world created by them that anyone who would turn aside from the track already pointed out by them can scarcely count upon being understood by us. Our way of looking upon life and the world is determined by them to such an extent that no one can arouse our sympathetic interest who does not seek for points of contact with our world as thus determined. Only as regards one branch of our intellectual life must we admit that it has not yet found such a point of contact. It is that branch of knowledge which proceeds beyond the mere assemblage of observed data, beyond the cognizance of single experiences, and seeks to provide a satisfying total view of the world and of life. It is that which is generally called philosophy. For this, our classical period actually seems to be non-existent. It seeks its salvation in an artificial seclusion and aristocratic isolation from all the rest of our intellectual life. This statement cannot be disproved by reference to the fact that a number of older and younger philosophers and scientists have undertaken to interpret Goethe and Schiller, for these have not attained to their scientific standpoints by developing the germs existing in the scientific works of these heroes of the mind. They have arrived at their scientific standpoints apart from the world conception represented by Goethe and Schiller, and have afterward compared them with this. And this they have done not for the purpose of gaining from the scientific opinions of the great thinkers something to serve as a means of guidance for themselves, but rather to test these opinions and see whether they could be maintained in the face of their own course of reasoning. This point we shall later treat more thoroughly. First, however, we should like to point out the effects which this attitude toward the highest stage of evolution in contemporary culture produces in that field of knowledge with which we are concerned. A large part of the educated reading public of the present time will at once lay aside, unread, any literary scientific work which lays claim to being philosophical. Seldom, if ever, has philosophy enjoyed so little favor as at present. Except for the writings of Schopenhauer and Eduard von Hartmann, who have dealt with problems of life and the world of the most widespread interest, and have therefore gained a wide circulation, it is not too much to say that philosophical works are at present read only by professional philosophers. Nobody except these persons concerns himself with such writings. The educated man, who is not a specialist, has the vague feeling, quote, "These writings contain nothing suited to a person of my intellectual needs. What is there discussed does not concern me. It is in no way related to what I require for my mental satisfaction." Unquote. This lack of interest in philosophy cannot be due to anything other than the circumstance to which I have referred. For there exists, face to face with this indifference, an ever-increasing need for a satisfying conception of the world and of life. The dogmas of religion, which were for a long time an adequate substitute, are more and more losing their convincing power. The need is steadily growing to attain through thought to that which man once owed to faith in revelation, the satisfaction of his spirit. The interest of cultured persons could not therefore be lacking if this particular branch of knowledge marched in step with the whole evolution of culture, if its representatives would take up a position with reference to the great questions that move humanity. In this matter, we must always keep before our minds the truth that the proper procedure is never that of creating a spiritual need artificially, but quite the contrary, that of discovering the need which exists and satisfying this need. The task of science is not that of propounding questions, but that of giving careful attention to these when they are put forth by human nature and by the contemporary stage of evolution, and of answering them. Our modern philosophers set tasks for themselves that are not at all the outflow of that stage of culture whereon we now stand, questions for which no one is seeking answers. Those questions which must be propounded by our culture because of the position to which our great thinkers have elevated it are passed over by science. Thus we possess a philosophical knowledge which no one is seeking, and suffer from a philosophical need which no one satisfies. Our central branch of knowledge, that which ought to solve for us the real world riddle, must not be an exception in comparison with all other branches of the intellectual life. It must seek for its sources where these have been found by the others. It must not only take cognizance of the great classic thinkers, but also seek in them the germs for its own evolution. The same wind must blow through this as through the rest of our culture. This is a necessity inhering in the very nature of things. To this necessity must we ascribe the fact that modern researchers have undertaken to interpret our classic writers as we have explained above. These interpretations reveal nothing more than a vague feeling that it will not suffice simply to pass over the convictions of those thinkers and proceed with the order of the day. But they prove only that no one has arrived at the point of a further developing of their opinions. This is evidenced by the manner in which the approach is made to Lessing, Herder, Goethe, and Schiller. In spite of all the excellence of many productions of this class, it must be said of almost everything that has been written in regard to the scientific works of Schiller and Goethe that it is not developed organically from Schiller's or Goethe's own views, but takes a retrospective relationship to them. Nothing can more strongly substantiate this than the fact that representatives of the most diverse tendencies in science have seen in Goethe the genius who experienced beforehand premonitions of their points of view. Representatives of world conceptions, which possess absolutely nothing in common, refer with seemingly equal justification to Goethe, when they feel the need to see their respective points of view recognized at a high point in human history. One can scarcely imagine a sharper contrast than that between the teachings of Hegel and Schopenhauer. The latter calls Hegel a charlatan, and his philosophy a meaningless rubbish of words, mere nonsense, barbaric word combinations. The two men actually have nothing whatever in common except their unlimited admiration for Goethe and their belief that he acknowledged himself as adhering to their respective views of the world. Nor is the case different as regards more recent scientific tendencies. Haeckel, who has elaborated Darwinism with the gift of genius and with a logic as inflexible as iron, and whom we must consider by far the most significant follower of the English investigator, sees in Goethe's point of view the anticipation of his own. Another contemporary scientific investigator, A. F. W. Jessen, writes in regard to the theory of Darwin, quote, "The stir which has been created among many specialists in research and many laymen by this theory, often before brought forward and as often disproved by thorough investigation, but now supported by many apparently sound judgments, shows how little, unfortunately, the results of scientific research are known and understood by people," unquote. Footnote, all numerical notations refer to comments beginning on page 119. And footnote, in that he found, through a thoughtful, deeply penetrating observation of nature, the fundamental law of all plant formation. That was in quotes. Each of these two investigators is able to cite a wearisome number of illustrations to show the harmony existing between his own scientific tendency and the, quote, thoughtful observations of Goethe, unquote. But if each of these standpoints could justly refer to Goethe's thought, this must cast a dubious light upon the unity of that thinking. The basis of this phenomenon, however, lies in the very fact that neither of these points of view really grows out of Goethe's world conception, but each has its roots quite outside that conception. The phenomenon arises from the fact that men seek out external agreement as to details torn out of the totality of Goethe's thought, and thus deprived of their meaning, but are not willing to attribute to this totality the inner fitness to serve as the basis for a scientific trend of thought. Goethe's opinions have never been made points of departure for scientific researches, but always only material for instituting comparisons. Those who have busied themselves with these opinions have seldom been students surrendering themselves with unprejudiced minds to his ideas, but usually critics sitting in judgment upon him. It is even said that Goethe had far too little scientific sense, that he was all the worse philosopher for being so excellent a poet, that for this reason it would be impossible to find in him the basis for a scientific point of view. This is an utter misconception of Goethe's nature. Goethe was, to be sure, no philosopher in the ordinary sense of the term, but it must not be forgotten that the wonderful harmony of his personality led Schiller to declare, quote, "the poet is the only true human being," unquote. What Schiller here intended by the expression, quote, "true human being," unquote, this Goethe was. No element belonging to the very highest form of the universally human was lacking in his personality. But all these elements united in him to form a totality which is, as such, effectual. Thus it comes about that his opinions regarding nature rest upon a profound philosophical sense, even though this philosophical sense does not enter his consciousness in the form of definite scientific statements. Whoever immerses himself in that totality will be able, provided he brings with him philosophic capacities, to release this philosophic sense and set it forth as Goethe's form of knowledge. But he must take his point of departure from Goethe and not approach him with a ready-made opinion. Goethe's intellectual powers are always effective in the manner requisite to the most rigid philosophy, even though he has not left such a philosophy as a complete system. Goethe's view of the world is the most many-sided imaginable. It proceeds from a central point which rests in the unified nature of the poet, and it always brings to the fore that side which corresponds to the nature of the object. The unity of the activity of intellectual forces lies in the nature of Goethe. The temporary form of that activity is determined by the object concerned. Goethe borrowed his manner of observation from the external world instead of obtruding his own upon the world. Now the thinking of many men is effectual only in one definite way. It serves only for a certain type of objects. It is not unified, as was Goethe's, but only uniform. Let us endeavor to express this more thoroughly. There are men whose intellects are especially adapted to think out merely mechanical interdependencies and effects. They conceive the entire universe as a mechanism. Others have the impulse to take into consciousness everywhere the secret mystical element in the external world. They become adherents of mysticism. All sorts of errors arise from the fact that such a way of thinking, entirely appropriate to one type of objects, is declared to be universal. This explains the conflict between various world conceptions. If a thinker holding such a one-sided conception confronts Goethe's view, which is unlimited, because it always takes its manner of observation not from the mind of the observer, but from the nature of the thing observed, then it may easily be understood that this one-sided thinker lays hold upon that element in Goethe's thought which harmonizes with his own. Goethe's view of the world includes within itself, in just the sense indicated, many tendencies of thought, whereas it cannot in turn be penetrated by any one-sided conception. The philosophical sense, which is an essential element in the organism of the genius of Goethe, is also significant from the point of view of his poetry. Though it was alien to Goethe's mind to set forth in clear conceptual form what was mediated to him by this sense, as was done by Schiller, yet the philosophical sense was an active factor in his artistic creative work, as in that of Schiller. Goethe's and Schiller's poetic productions are unthinkable apart from their world conception, which was the background. In this matter, we are concerned more with the actually formulated basic principles in Schiller, but in Goethe rather with the manner in which he looked at things. But the fact that the greatest poets of our nation, at the climax of their creative work, could not do without that philosophical element proves more than all else that this is a necessary constituent in the history of human evolution. Resting upon Goethe and Schiller will enable us to tear our central science away from its academic isolation and incorporate it into the rest of our cultural evolution. The scientific convictions of our great thinkers of the classic age are bound by 1,000 ties to their other endeavors. They are such as were demanded by the cultural epoch which created them. Chapter 2. Goethe's Science Considered According to the Method of Schiller. In the preceding pages we have determined the direction that is to be taken by the following inquiries. They are to constitute a development of that which became manifest in Goethe as a scientific sense, an interpretation of his way of observing the world. The objection may be raised that this is not the way in which to present a point of view scientifically. A scientific opinion must never, under any circumstances, rest upon authority, but must always rest upon principles. Let us at once discuss this objection. An opinion, based upon Goethe's world conception, is not accepted by us as truth, simply because it can be deduced from this conception, but because we believe that Goethe's view of the world can be supported by tenable, basic principles, and can be represented as a self-sustaining view. The fact that we take our point of departure from Goethe shall not prevent us from being just as much concerned to show grounds for the opinions maintained by us as are the exponents of any science which claims to be free from presuppositions. We represent Goethe's view of the world, but we shall confirm this according to the requirements of science. The road that must be taken by such inquiries has already been indicated by Schiller. No one perceived the greatness of Goethe's genius so clearly as did he. In his letters to Goethe, he held up before the latter an image of Goethe's own nature. In his letters concerning the aesthetic education of the human race, he develops the ideal of the artist as he had recognized this in Goethe. And in his essays on naive and sentimental poetry, he describes the nature of genuine art as he had come to know this in the poetical works of Goethe. This is our justification for designating our discussion as being built upon the foundation of the Goethe-Schiller world conception. Its purpose is to consider the scientific thought of Goethe according to the method for which Schiller has already provided a model. Goethe's look is directed toward nature and toward life, and the manner of observation followed by him shall be the subject, the content, of our discussion. Schiller's book is directed toward the mind of Goethe, and the manner of observation which he followed shall be the ideal of our own method. In this manner, we believe the scientific endeavors of Goethe and Schiller are made fruitful for the present age. According to the customary scientific terminology, our work must be conceived as a theory of knowledge. The questions discussed will indeed be of a very different sort from those which are now almost always posed by that branch of philosophy. We have seen why this is so. Where similar inquiries appear nowadays, they almost invariably take Kant as their point of departure. It has been altogether overlooked in scientific circles that beside the science of knowledge set up by the great thinker of Königsberg, there is at least the possibility of another trend of thought in this field, no less capable than that of Kant, of dealing profoundly with the facts. Otto Liebmann, at the beginning of the 60s, gave expression to the conviction that we must return to Kant if we would attain to a view of the world free of contradictions. This is the reason why we possess today a Kant literature almost beyond the possibility of survey. But this road also will fail to afford any assistance to philosophical thinking, which will not again play a role in our cultural life until, instead of returning to Kant, it enters more deeply into the scientific conceptions of Goethe and Schiller. And now we shall touch upon one of the basic questions of a science of knowledge corresponding to these preliminary remarks. Chapter 3. The function of this branch of science. With regard to all knowledge, that holds true which Goethe expressed so aptly in the words, quote, "Theory is of no use in and of itself, save as it causes us to believe in the interrelationship of phenomena," end quote. By means of science, we are always bringing separate facts of experience into relationship. We perceive in inorganic nature causes and effects separated, and we seek for their connection in the appropriate sciences. In the organic world, we become aware of species and genera of organisms, and we endeavor to establish the reciprocal relationships among them. Single cultural epochs of humanity appear before us in history, and we endeavor to learn the interdependence of one evolutionary stage upon another. Thus, every branch of science has to work in some definite field of phenomena in the sense conveyed by the statement quoted above from Goethe. Each branch of science has its sphere in which it seeks for the interrelationship among phenomena, but there yet remains a great antithesis in our scientific endeavors. On one side, the ideal world, footnote, die ideale Welt, the world of ideas, gained by the sciences, and on the other the objects upon which that world is based. There must be a branch of science which here also clarifies the interrelationships, the ideal and the real world, the antithesis between idea and reality. These constitute the problem of such a science. These contrasting elements also must be understood in their reciprocal relationships. It is the purpose of the following discussion to seek for these relationships. The facts of science on the one hand and nature and history on the other are to be brought into relationship. What is the significance of the reflection of the external world in human consciousness? Let me read that again. What is the significance of the reflection of the external world in human consciousness? Next question. What relationship exists between our thinking about the objects of reality and these objects themselves? Part B, Experience. Chapter 4, Definition of the Concept of Experience. Two spheres thus stand over against one another: our thinking and the objects with which this is occupied. These latter are designated, insofar as they are accessible to our observation, as the content of experience. Whether or not there are other objects of thought outside the field of our observation, and of what sort these may be, we shall for the moment leave undetermined. Our first task shall be to fix sharply the boundaries of the two spheres, experience and thought. We must first have experience before us in determinate outlines, and then investigate the nature of thought. Here we enter upon the first task. What is experience? Everyone is conscious of the fact that his thinking is kindled through collision with reality. Objects meet us in space and time. We become aware of an external world of many parts, very highly complicated, and we live in a more or less richly elaborated inner world. The first form in which all this meets us is already fixed. We have no share in its coming to pass. It is as if springing forth from an unknown beyond that reality first offers itself to the grasp of our senses and our minds. At first we can do nothing more than to permit our look to sweep over the multiplicity which meets us. This first activity of ours is the grasp of the senses upon reality. We must grasp firmly what is offered to the senses, for it is only this that we can call pure experience. We feel forthwith the need to penetrate by means of the classifying intellect into the unending multiplicity of forms, forces, colors, tones, etc., which appear to us. We are impelled to explain the mutual interdependencies of all the single entities that come to meet us. When an animal appears in a determinate region, we inquire regarding the influence of the latter upon the life of this animal. If we see that a stone begins to roll, we seek for other occurrences with which this is connected. But what comes about in this fashion is no longer pure experience. It has already a twofold origin, experience and thinking. Pure experience is that form of reality in which it appears to us when we meet it with the complete exclusion of ourselves. It is to this form of reality that we may apply the words Goethe used in his essay entitled Nature, quote, "We are surrounded and encircled by her. Unbidden and without warning, she takes us up in the round of her dance." Unquote. As regards the objects of the external senses, this fact stares us in the face, so that it will scarcely be denied by anyone. A body appears at first before us as a complex of forms, colors, sensations of heat and light, which are suddenly there, as if they had come forth from a primal source to us, quite unknown. The psychological conviction that the sense world, as it lies before us, is in itself nothing but a product of the interaction between our organism and an external world of molecules unknown to us does not contradict our assertion. If it were really true that color, heat, etc. were nothing more than the manner in which our organism is affected by the external world, yet the process which metamorphoses the occurrences of the external world into color, heat, etc. lies entirely beyond our consciousness. Whatever may be the role played in this by our organism, what appears to our thought as the already existent form of reality, not subject to our control, that is, experience, is not the molecular occurrence. It is those colors, tones, etc. The matter is not so clear in the case of our inner life. But adequate consideration will here remove all doubt that our inner states also appear on the horizon of consciousness in the same form as do the things and facts of the external world. A feeling makes its impact upon me as does a sensation of light. The fact that I bring it into nearer relationship with my own personality has no significance from this point of view. We must go still further. Even thought itself appears to us at first as an item of experience. In the very act of examining our thought, we set it over against ourselves. We conceive its first form as coming from an unknown source. This cannot be otherwise. Our thinking, especially when we lay hold upon its form as an individual activity within consciousness, is contemplation. That is, it directs the look outward toward what stands before it. Here it remains at first as activity. It would look into emptiness, into nothing, if something did not exist over against it. Everything which is to become an object of our knowledge must adapt itself to this form of setting itself before us. We are incapable of lifting ourselves above this form. If we are to win, in thinking, a means for deeper penetration into the world, then thought itself must first become experience. We must seek for thought itself as one among the facts of experience. Only thus will our world conception avoid the loss of inner unity. This would occur at once should we attempt to bring into it an alien element. We stand facing pure experience and seeking within experience for that element which sheds light over itself and over the rest of reality. It'll be the first recorded section of this, and it's up to page 17. That's where I'll begin next time. I will begin on Chapter 5, Examination of the Content of Experience.